Jesus caused outrage in the temple because he healed a woman. She had been chronically ill for 18 years. So why the outrage? Was it because she was a woman? Possibly. But the official reason that he healed her on that Sabbath day was that he broke the Sabbath law. She was ecstatic, of course, and she sang praises to God. The congregation was impressed and amazed and shared her joy. But the religious leaders of that congregation did not share the woman's joy or the congregation's joy. Instead of rejoicing that after such a long illness the woman had been healed, they were furious and they accused Jesus of breaking the law. The Jewish leaders condemned Jesus' actions because to them the law, which involved not working on the Sabbath, was more important than the needs of people. I believe that those religious leaders enjoyed the power of enforcing the law. Yes, they were so fanatical about the imperative of the law that they had apparently lost any sense of feeling and compassion for people. But when we take a look at the law as Christ interpreted it, it doesn't lead to a works righteousness equation or contract. It leads to other-centred love. If I asked you to give me an indication by a show of hands whether, for you, it is more important to keep the Sabbath day holy by not doing any work, or to do some good work on the Sabbath day, such as healing, I'm pretty confident that all of you here would say it's okay to work and to heal on the Sabbath. You'd probably even go further and say that it is our Christian obligation and responsibility to do so. However, for some people, for some sects, some religions, some denominations, even today the answer is not as simple nor as clear-cut as I believe that it is for most of us here. The fourth commandment is recorded in Exodus 20, verses 8 following, and the King James Version says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work." Of course, we're more used to Nathan's more straightforward paraphrasing, which simply reads, "Keep up the practice of making Saturday a dedicated rest day. You are to work out your business, projects and chores on the other 6 days, and keep the seventh day as a rest day, dedicated to me, the Lord your God." Question. Do you really know what Sabbath keeping is like? I do, and I'll tell you all about it. I grew up in a mixed congregational household last century. My mother was a Seventh-day Adventist. My father was a Methodist. And for those of you young things who don't know what Methodism is, the Uniting Church in Australia these days is basically a combination of Methodists and Presbyterians. So, growing up in this household with a Seventh-day Adventist mother and a staunch Methodist father, I know a lot about keeping the Sabbath. From the Seventh-day Adventist side of my childhood, the Sabbath began at sunset on Friday and ended at sunset on Saturday. And during that period of time, we're not allowed to do any work, go to the shops, play sport, go fishing, do any gardening, or even study. All of that was work and was thus prohibited. But as my father was a Methodist, I had to experience a second Sabbath. And that began at midnight on Saturday and ended at midnight on Sunday. Similar rules or prohibitions applied. However, I was allowed to go fishing on Sundays, I was allowed to play sport, I was allowed to do garden, and I was allowed to study. Shopping was not a problem, as in those days, last century, it was illegal for shops, including petrol stations, to open on a Sunday. But although I was allowed to play tennis or golf on a Sunday, I was forbidden to buy any drinks at the tennis club or the golf course. I had to endure two Sabbaths. Legalism pervaded the whole experience. I saw it all as prohibitive and restrictive, especially as the Catholic kids and the Anglicans were allowed to buy a milkshake on a Saturday or a Sunday. My religious host at the time taught me that unless you kept the Sabbath strictly, you had no chance of going to heaven. As I look back on it now, that religious upbringing promoted a transactional type of religion. A transactional type of religion based on fear. Obey the law, keep the Sabbath, or face the prospect of hell. So much for Mark 2, verse 27, which reads, "The Sabbath was made for man." Or as we would today say, the Sabbath was made for humankind. And add to that, no card playing, no dancing, no alcohol, no cinema. No wonder I grew up believing that religion was a transactional, behaviour reward type process. Obey the law or look forward to eternal punishment or damnation. And that's the type of situation I believe that the religious leaders of Jesus' day imposed on that congregation at that temple. For some religious people, their church is not a safe or a happy religious home. But for some people, religion can be and can become a prison. For them, legal compliance is paramount and overrides the Christian principles of love, joy, and peace. For some Christian people, their religious experience is transactional, a bit like a supermarket experience. Obey, be legalistic or even robotic, and you will earn the reward, eternal salvation. This transactional notion of Christianity or religiosity is fear-based, the aim of which is to avoid hell and eternal rejection. But for some people it is so real, no wonder its adherents so often look so unhappy. That's the type of religious behaviour that the religious leaders of Jesus' day were enforcing. Jesus tells us only to judge others as much as we want to be judged ourselves, and to extend grace and mercy to others in the same way we want it extended to us. Fortunately, I now understand and believe that true Christianity is not transactional but transformational. We are changed, transformed through the grace of Jesus Christ. Our promised salvation is a gift given us through grace by Jesus Christ. It is not something we deserve, nor is it something we can buy or earn by obeying the law or the laws. Now back to the legalism of the religious leaders of Jesus' day. The Talmud says that there are 613 commandments in the Torah. 248 positive commandments, they're the do's, and there are 365 negative commandments, they're the do nots. In reality, that meant that there were 613 commandments which had to be approached and completed in a transactional way for a Jewish person at this time to be deemed to live according to the law. What a big ask. It is recorded that Jesus had many run-ins with the established religious community of the day and its supporters, especially the leaders. He challenged their lack of compassion, their lack of love and care for people, their emphasis on legalism. This type of religious legal battle still continues today in some places. Jesus taught love. Jesus practiced love. God's form of justice is restoration, reconciliation, not punishment and retribution. God's intention was to bring about a culture of grace and other-centered love. But there is a sad story of Christianity using, or should I say, misusing, or maybe even abusing, sometimes using, abusing, misusing the Bible to justify hate, legalism, injustice, and discrimination. Last week, Nathan said from this pulpit, a lot of horrendous things have been done in the name of God. Karen Armstrong, a British ex-nun and author of A History of God, wrote that religion has been co-opted to reinforce injustice. Religion has been co-opted to reinforce injustice. The Bible has been used to justify racism and slavery and to promote white supremacy. Which prompts me, this is not really in the script, but being Middle Eastern, Jesus probably had a pretty good suntan. But when we look at so much Western art, Jesus is portrayed as a white person. Paul, you think you've probably run out of artistic projects, but probably your next project is to paint a series with Jesus having a pretty good suntan.
I bought a wonderful painting a few months ago from Millet, before I was born. This was done before I was born. Jesus is about 7 foot tall, blonde and blue eyed.
I've given you a different challenge for your next book.
It is not the way I see it, but I was just so chuffed.
Right. Okay, the Bible has been used to subjugate women. The Bible has been used to justify the non-ordination of women. The Bible has been used to justify discriminate against GLBTI and other non-conforming sexual minorities. The Bible has been used to deny the sacrament to divorcees. And so I could go on. Christian fundamentalism is based on sheer, unswerving adherence to the law. I believe that fundamentalism, in actual fact, betrays true Christianity. True Christianity is love, love, love. Growth, growth, growth. Transformation, healing. But for some Christian fundamentalists, compliance with their religious laws is so important they lose any sense of fairness and justice. Obeying the law becomes an obsession, the only thing which really matters. Religious fundamentalism, the implementation of legalism, isn't about religion or spirituality. It is about power. What is it that the religious leaders of Jesus' day feared? Was it a loss of power if Jesus' simple message of love and healing, other-centeredness, was allowed to develop and flourish? They would lose their power. They would lose their control. Religious fundamentalists have a theology of fear, self-righteousness, greed, and hypocrisy. It fosters an us-them mentality. No wonder Mahatma Gandhi said, "I like your Christ, but I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." Perhaps this is why the world around us still regards Christ with great esteem, but in general holds a very low view of Christians. Jesus taught, preached, and practiced love. He tried to change the religious community and society of his day, and indeed our day. He offered and brought hope to an otherwise unhappy and legalistic world. Today, many people have turned their back on Christianity, claiming it is too legalistic, too hypocritical, or just not appropriate for the 21st century. At a time when the Christian religion is too often portrayed as narrow-minded and exclusive, we have an obligation and an opportunity to model the true principles of Jesus' love and healing. The gospel of Jesus Christ is and must be transformational. The grace of Jesus Christ is sufficient to transform us all. The grace of Jesus Christ is sufficient to transform the world. And we need to let the world know about this transformational gospel, which can bring hope, healing, peace, equality, and love. Other-centeredness. Together, we can help to grow a more just and more peaceful world based on the loving principles of our hero, Jesus Christ. There is a saying, sometimes attributed to St. Francis of Assisi, "Go and preach the gospel, use words if necessary." That's certainly not saying earn your salvation by slavish adherence to the law. What it is saying is live your life with love and compassion. That may be the only gospel some people read. Archbishop Desmond Tutu has said, "Love is much more demanding than the law." In the temple on that Sabbath day, Jesus broke the law of the religious leaders of his day. By so doing, he showed other-centered love as he healed a woman who had been chronically ill for 18 years. His actions achieved much more than just keeping the law would have. It healed a woman and encouraged the congregation to rethink its stance to healing, to life, to each other, and hopefully to the law. Jesus challenged the conventional religious practices of his day. Similarly, today we need to accept that Christianity is a dynamic entity, constantly changing to adapt to new situations as they emerge. Like Jesus, we need to continue to comfort the disturbed. But we also need to disturb the comfortable. Perhaps John Wesley's rule summarizes it all. do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, for as long as ever you can. Amen.